Good afternoon, everyone. It's afternoon by 1 minute. Very warm welcome to Chatham House. I'm Bronwyn Maddox. I'm the director. And we're delighted to be hosting today David Lammy, the Shadow Foreign Secretary. Been in the job over 14 months, a very eventful 14 months, for his speech on what is Labour's foreign policy. I tell my colleagues at Chatham House that we pride ourselves in not only imposing the good questions, but also in answering them, and that is what David Lammy is going to do today on that. If you want to tweet along, we'd be delighted with the hashtag CHEvents, or follow us at Chatham House. I suspect there will be lots of questions. Thank you very much to those of us, those of you who are joining us online, which is great. David's going to talk for about half an hour in a speech that he tells me is packed with policy. And he's been talking for about 6 hours already today on aspects of this. I will fire a few questions at him, but I'm going to leave the time for those of you who want to ask questions. So start getting them ready. David, enormously warm welcome to Chatham House. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Well, look, can I begin by saying thank you to Chatham House for hosting me here today. In so many ways, this is an institution that encapsulates Britain in the world at its best, a trusted force for good, universally respected, globally networked, and of course, influential. And I'm very, very grateful to you, Bronwyn, for asking me to do this. We meet at a time when Britain sadly feels lost and disconnected. In a world that is more divided than at any time since the fall of the Berlin Wall. And there are three trends that are shaping foreign policy. And the next Labour government will inherit these trends. The first is that we are in a new geopolitical age of competition. We see it in the bloody war on our continent. We see it in a world economy splitting into blocks, as global competition between the United States and China shapes our century, and regional powers make that contest multipolar. From the vast collective bloc of the European Union to the more assertive middle powers in the Middle East and other areas throwing their weight around. The second major trend is weaponized interdependence. The ties that bind us together are now also driving fragmentation on trade, on industry, on energy, migration, and the internet and new technologies, from artificial intelligence to automation to quantum and biotech, all of these being risked, being used as tools of authoritarian power. Less a new order and more a new polarised disorder. Third is the trend that I will focus on most today. There's been a blurring of the distinction between foreign and domestic policy. As President Biden has said, there's no longer a bright line between the two. In a world that is independent, foreign policy has become domestic policy, and domestic policy has become foreign policy. We can see this in every village, in every town, and every city in the United Kingdom. Most of you know me as the Member of Parliament for Tottenham in North London. But it's less well known that I spent much of my childhood in the cathedral city of Peterborough, studying at a state boarding school. And it's easy to see the impact of global trends in a community like Tottenham. But the impact of the world on Peterborough has been just as transformative. I went back a couple of years ago to have lunch with Clive and Kathy, the parents of my school best friend, over tea in their bungalow in the city. They told me how at home they felt Peterborough was changing from when they were young. Now they feel powerless as their grandchildren struggle to find decent jobs. The industrial workplaces of the past not yet replaced by the green jobs of the future. They feel like their community has been eroded as neighbouring families move out. And they tell me they feel insecure on their street as they walk home at night, as the tentacles of international criminal gangs have reached into their neighbourhood. This is not just down to domestic policy, policing, housing, or education, but a failure of the Conservative government to grasp the impacts of foreign policy, globalisation, and economic change on all of our communities, leaving not only families, but a nation feeling lost and disconnected. To help communities like Peterborough, Labour's foreign policy must adapt and meet these three tectonic shifts, fragmenting the world with three unifying principles. The first is that British foreign policy must seek to take back control. The Conservatives were right about that, but they were fundamentally wrong to think it means going it alone. In the modern world, we maximise our influence by reconnecting Britain with our allies and partners. The second is that our foreign policy must put pragmatism over ideology. Making decisions based on what will advance the British public's security and prosperity, not the ideological purity of the ERG. And the third is that our foreign policy choices must be made for the many, not the few, putting the consumer before the fossil fuel company, the small business owner before the hedge fund manager, the NHS patient before the tax exile. The test that lies behind all of these principles is simple. Will our choices help hard-working families in a more dangerous world where the borders between foreign and domestic policy are breaking down? The lack of purpose in Britain's foreign policy stems from both bad choices and institutional dysfunction. We have left the European Union, but not yet found a new, settled and confident place in Europe. Our country's reputation for the rule of law has been badly damaged. Our leadership in development has been squandered. The foundations of our defences have been weakened. Our soft power has been corroded, and our climate leadership forsaken. It is, I'm afraid, a sad, dismal record. I take no pleasure in saying that. We all have a stake in the success of our country, and a future Labour government will inherit the consequences of these choices. It will fall to us to rebuild the foundations of our influence in the world again. And my vision is of a Britain reconnected, secure at home and strong abroad, a confident country outside of the European Union, but a leader in Europe once again, a reliable partner, a dependable ally, a good neighbour. NATO's leading European power, a development superpower once more, at the vanguard of climate action, driving forward the industries of the future of Britain, a diplomatic entrepreneur and a country that keeps its word. In government, we will announce a new mission statement for the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office designed around five clear goals. One, a Britain reconnected to defend the UK's security with strong armed forces and resilience against the 21st century threats. Two, a Britain reconnected to champion the UK's prosperity and lead the industries of the future. Three, a Britain reconnected for climate action, turning our response into an engine of growth. Four, a Britain reconnected for international development, helping to promote the UK's security, health and jobs in the process. And five, a Britain reconnected for diplomacy, to re-establish the United Kingdom as a trusted, reliable and influential partner while protecting Britons abroad. Let me start with security. whether you get your news from the television or from scrolling through social media. The public understand that we face a more insecure world than at any time since the height of the Cold War. I visited Kyiv a couple of weeks before the invasion to show our solidarity in the face of Russia's imperial threats. From the beginning of the crisis through to the recent decision to send Challenger tanks, the government has had Labour's support, total support, in providing Ukraine with the military, economic, diplomatic, and humanitarian assistance it needs to defend itself. Britain is united on this. Whoever's in government, the UK will stand with Ukraine for the long haul. It was a Labour Foreign Secretary who was the driving force behind the creation of NATO 70 years ago. Today, as then, Labour's commitment to NATO is unshakable. That's why I visited Stockholm and Helsinki last year to show our support for their NATO ambitions. Our commitment to Britain's independent nuclear deterrent is unambiguous, and we know the value in deepening our alliances beyond Europe too, be that with Australia through AUKUS or our new defence cooperation with Japan. But it's in Europe, the first priority for our own security, where a Labour government would forge a new security approach. At present, our influence in Europe has waned. I felt this recently in Kosovo, where I met with the Prime Minister, the President, and the small group of British troops at the K4 base. From the Kremlin's influence to migration and organised crime, many of the forces threatening Kosovo are those threatening Britain too. But despite all the goodwill I felt towards Britain, from back when a Labour government led Europe in decisive action to stop ethnic cleansing, the Tories have left Britain on the sidelines, locked us out of the diplomatic process centred now on the European Union. There's no doubt our heft could help. But to do that, we must cement our traditional friendships. New initiatives like the European Political Community have real potential, but they illustrate the way that we have left others to do the running and take the lead. Europeans are more than just trading partners. We share security and fate in this changing world, in Kyiv, in Kosovo, and with terrorism right here at home. We need a Britain reconnected for security. That's why we will pursue a new UK-EU security pact to complement our unshakable commitment to NATO. We will seek to institutionalise new cooperation across foreign policy through regular EU-UK summits and structured dialogue, both at the political and official level. And as my excellent colleague and friend, the Shadow Defence Secretary, John Healey, has said, we would negotiate new mechanisms for cooperation on hybrid threats between EU and UK defence industries. The specific areas of cooperation are, of course, a matter of negotiation. But from sanctions to energy security and space capabilities and new technology, we can see how developing deeper connections with Europeans can make Britain stronger and safer. We need to think about security in a holistic way. Tanks, planes and ships matter as much as they ever have, but they are just the tip of the security iceberg. Today, conflicts are also waged by controlling energy prices, by using critical technologies or resources as bargaining chips, by cyber attacks and misinformation, by detaining foreign nationals. Threats are often in the grey zone. The Russian state murdering people on UK soil with a chemical weapon, influencing operations against our democracy, targeting parliamentarians. These threats need a coordinated response. And that is why today I'm announcing that Labour will create a new joint FCDO Home Office State Threats Cell, working in partnership with the intelligence and security agencies to assess state threats, disrupt hostile actors, improve resilience in both government and the private sector, and coordinate with international partners. Labour, we will build the foundations of our defence, lead in NATO, build new ties with Europe, and strengthen Britain's resilience. Next, I want to talk about prosperity, because growing up poor in Tottenham in Thatcher's Britain. I know the pain of living through a cost of living crisis. Every week I meet constituents still suffering from a lack of opportunity and the indignity of choosing between eating and heating. Keir Starmer's Green Prosperity Plan will reindustrialise the UK, supporting the creation of over 200,000 jobs over the next decade. But we're not alone in wanting to accelerate into green industries. China, the United States, the European Union, all taking steps to become green superpowers. China already has the largest market share in every single stage of solar panel manufacturing. And the US has passed the landmark Inflation Reduction Act. I welcome efforts to accelerate along the path to net zero from other countries. But if we do not use our power smartly, we risk falling behind. That is why our £28 billion Green Prosperity Plan will use our many strengths, such as our position as a world leader in wind power and our renewable research base, to build political, scientific and commercial alliances to grow prosperity in the UK. And we will make Britain's prosperity more resilient. Successive crises, from the pandemic to the war in Ukraine, have demonstrated the vulnerability to international supply chains. As the transition from fossil fuels accelerates, dramatic industrial shifts are creating new demand for technological critical materials like cobalt and lithium. But where is the new drive to reflect the shifting resource economy? We need to move rapidly to reduce our exposure to volatility and our vulnerability to geo-economic pressure. But Britain is falling woefully behind. The US CHIPS legislation will provide $52 billion in subsidies to US chip manufacturers. The EU CHIPS Act will provide 43 billion euros. But the UK has put aside just £700,000 to commission a research project. And it's still not published its promised semiconductor strategy. Labour will publish one within the first parliamentary session. Unconstrained globalisation has played its part in the turbulence we've seen in recent years. You can see this in Peterborough today. However, we must not let this deter us from the opportunities that globalisation can bring. And that's what I want for Peterborough tomorrow. Labour will drive up trade across the UK, harness the power of our Green Prosperity Plan to fuel exports and growth. We will build global alliances and partnerships, strike deals that deliver jobs and opportunity at home while promoting prosperity and fairness around the world. Good jobs, strong growth, and real opportunities, a framework business can trust. But we will also ensure that global corporations pay their fair share. It's why Labour led the calls for a windfall tax on oil and gas profits, and it's why we will bear down on tax havens and press other countries to put the global minimum corporation tax into domestic law. Any serious discussion about increasing prosperity in Britain must include the £15 trillion elephant in the room. The European market just across our shores. It has been a central principle of British strategy for centuries that we should never find ourselves isolated in our own continent. But that is exactly what this government has done. It is time to put what the Economist has called the magical thinking of the Conservative Party to one side. And that means, yes, recognising the damage the government's bad Brexit deal has done to our economy, investment down, growth sluggish or non-existent. 45% of businesses say they're having difficulties trading with the European Union. The number exporting to Europe has fallen by a third. In the middle of a cost of living crisis, this is a scandal. And the Labour Party's not afraid to say so. Reconnecting Britain to Europe while remaining outside of the European Union will be our top priority for the next Labour Foreign Office. Keir Starmer has been clear. With Labour, Britain will not rejoin the European Union, the single market, or the customs union. But within our red lines, there can be real progress that we can make to increase trade with our neighbours and deliver prosperity at home. And we aim to fix the Tories' bad Brexit deal to increase trade with Europe. That includes fixing the Northern Ireland Protocol, reducing friction on food, on agriculture, medical and veterinary goods, strengthening mutual recognition of professional standards and qualifications to unlock trade and services, unblocking participation in the Horizon Scheme to unleash research and development, using the 2025 TCA review to reduce barriers to trade and improving links between our students and universities. From Paris to Berlin, Dublin to Warsaw, we will rebuild bilateral relationships with key European partners. A modern Britain in a changing world must invest in partnerships and traditional allies in Europe, but also in North America and the Commonwealth. We will develop a new initiative to build dynamic partnerships with African nations, recognising that by 2050, one in four people will be from that continent. A Labour government will build on the government's new commitment to the Indo-Pacific. China's rising economic and political power is the most significant change in global affairs in the last three decades. And by 2050, Asia will comprise more than half of the global economy. So this is not about tilting one way or the other. It's an essential response on the shifting centre of gravity in world affairs, maintaining serious, long-term, strategic approaches in this vital region of the world. And we need a Britain reconnected for climate action. The UN warned recently that the world is on course for a catastrophic 2.8 degrees of warming. This would deliver an era of cascading risks as extreme heat, sea level rises, drought and famine become more frequent. It's easy to dismiss the climate crisis as a problem for other parts of the world, but try to tell that to the courageous mother of Ellie Kissadebra, a 9-year-old girl from southeast London who was killed in part by the unlawful levels of air pollution near her home. Climate action is deeply intertwined with protecting Britain's prosperity and security. Decarbonisation is now a vital national security imperative. The faster we can transition to clean power, the quicker we can undermine Putin's war effort. Every solar panel is a shield to Putin's aggression. Every wind farm, a defence against dependency. And in developing our homegrown energy systems, we can build the green jobs and transformational industries of the future. Climate action is not just the ethical choice, it's the economic choice. It's the pro-business choice. It's the choice for growth. It's the choice for jobs. It's the choice for security. And it's the choice for communities in places like Peterborough. I'm proud that the next Labour government's foreign policy agenda will be centred on the climate emergency. Labour will push for climate action to become the fourth pillar at the United Nations. We will argue for the creation of a new law of ecocide to prosecute the widespread and intentional destruction of the planet. And as my friend and great colleague Ed Miliband has outlined, we will build a clean power alliance, an inverse OPEC of developed and developing nations committed to 100% clean power by 2030. Before Christmas, in a speech to Christian Aid, I outlined in detail how a Labour government will modernise development. Last year, I visited Afghanistan, the first UK politician to go to the country since the government's disastrous withdrawal. I was sitting in a classroom in District 17 of the northwest outskirts of Kabul with a group of women helping children displaced by war. A woman told me that she was considering selling a kidney so she could put food on the table for her family. I've never felt more conviction in my belief that development is vital in the modern world. Tackling poverty and climate change, improving health and education around the world is not only the moral choice, it is the strategic choice in our common interests. A way to make the British public safer, to reduce the drivers of conflict and migration, our development policy must aim at reducing global poverty. It should be proudly feminist, prioritising women and girls, with climate action and solidarity at the aid budget's heart. But it must also have a new focus on partnership, mutual respect and shared interests. Take, for the example, of the fair distribution of vaccines around the world. While Europeans were vaccinated many times over, much of the world waited for a first dose. This cannot and must not happen again. But our goal must be bigger. For intellectual property and manufacturing capacity to be shared across the world so that countries are producing their own vaccines, not waiting for others' leftovers. As well as being proudly British and European, if I become Foreign Secretary, I will not hide my transatlanticism. The relationship I formed as the first Black Briton to study at Harvard Law School have matured into deep bonds with many who work in Washington, D.C. Back in 97, when I was buried in legal textbooks, New Labour was just coming into office. There was deep excitement in the United States about the UK. We were seen as a dynamic and forward-looking country. Most of all, we were trusted as a reliable ally which would uphold the rule of law and defend the international system. It pains me to say that when I visit the United States these days, the chaos of the UK government is not seen as a joke, it's seen as a problem. What leaders in Washington think of the UK may seem distant from the public, but it matters to us all. It matters as we work with the US administration to maintain steadfast support for Ukraine and European security and tackle the climate change. And it matters if we want a trade deal eventually to bring benefit to Britain's economy. And so the final priority of the new Labour foreign policy must be diplomacy. Healing the rifts with the United States that the protocol fiasco has opened. Restoring our bonds with Europe to counter shared challenges. Building on partnership with a rising India and a rapidly growing African nations. And the Commonwealth provides a unique framework to partner with the Global South. Visit the capitals of the developing world, and it is glaringly obvious who is the key external driver of investment and construction. China. China's rise is indisputably the greatest change in the global system in my lifetime. But China's growth has been matched by greater repression at home and more assertive behaviour abroad, in Hong Kong, in Xinjiang, in Taiwan, and the South China Sea. Meanwhile, it singled out allies like Australia and Lithuania for hostile treatment and undermined the economic level playing field. The government is divided and inconsistent on China, flip-flopping between tough talk and muddled actions. Labour will be strong, clear-eyed and consistent, beginning with a complete audit of UK-China relationship, based on the strategies of three C's: challenge, compete, and where we can cooperate. Strong on national security, standing firm on human rights, but engaging where it's in our best interest to do so on climate change, on trade, and on global health. As a lawyer, and with a boss who is a lawyer, the rule of law will be at the heart of our approach to foreign policy. Britain's record of respect for the rule of law has become badly tarnished. Through the Overseas Operations Bill, the Internal Markets Bill, the Protocol Bill, and two Prime Ministers fined for breaking the law. This record damages our moral authority and political credibility. It shows us as unreliable, making future agreements harder to reach. It serves the interests of those who want to weaken the rule of law. It is unbefitting of this great country. The rule of law is not a Labour or a Conservative value. It is no exaggeration to say it is one of the greatest contributions our country has made to the world. No party owns it. No government should squander it. Britain should be a country that keeps its word. And let me tell you, Sir Keir Starmer, King's Counsel, as Prime Minister, will keep his. International rules and multilateral institutions are needed more than ever, but these have come under growing strain. The UN Security Council, hamstrung by the veto during perhaps the most blatant violation of the UN Charter since its creation. The WTO dispute settlement not functioning just as global trade becomes more contested. The World Bank failing in the face of the climate emergency. The WHO in need of reform before we face future pandemics. As we neglect multilateral institutions, China is intent on reshaping, in some cases, replacing them. But I still believe that multilateralism, incremental and imperfect as it is, remains absolutely vital and critical. A Labour government will declare an open-ended campaign to reform the UN Security Council in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Meanwhile, at the G20, Labour will push to make this crucial body, our multipolar world in our multipolar world, more effective. But while we hope to re-energise these institutions, we need to be prepared to operate beyond them. Labour will invest in AUKUS, support our deepening security partnership with Japan. We would build new networks and revive those that we've allowed to drift, like the E3 with France and Germany. To deliver this international effort, we need a strong Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. This government has overseen the mismanaged decline of this great office of state and left the FCDO without the economic and industrialised expertise to help navigate the challenges that Britain faces. Contrast this with France, where the French Foreign Ministry is growing its budget, hiring more diplomats and moving towards 0.78 target, not away from it. We need an FCDO ready for the challenges of the future and energised by a clear sense of purpose to focus the efforts of our brilliant diplomats, development professionals and intelligence agencies. And this is where I want to end. I want to show you what Labour's new approach looks like in a single policy: the fight against kleptocracy. I know this is an issue where Chatham House has led the charge, but the past year has laid bare a decade of chronic inaction against dirty money from Russia and other authoritarian states that has infiltrated the city. Money laundering has seen London homes become the bitcoins of kleptocrats, pricing out our frontline workers from their own homes. Corruption, bribery, and even financing of terrorist organisations here in the UK. This is not just a job for the police. This is foreign policy. I felt this when I visited Ukraine almost exactly 1 year ago, just before Putin's tanks rolled in. And as I sat with anti-corruption campaigners angry that Putin's oligarchs could launder their dirty money in Mayfair. They want Britain to act. I see this in Brussels, where the EU and UK officials have already been working together to coordinate sanctions policy, but are hamstrung by the Tories' bad deal in how we can cooperate further. They want a Britain to work with. I hear this in Washington, where today my friends Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and Senator Jean Shaheen are calling for the United States, Britain and the European Union to join forces to create a new transatlantic anti-corruption council to coordinate the fight. Labour will answer this call, not whistle the other way. We will reconnect Britain, but the work will start at home. We passionately believe in this great country. We feel the frustration of its disconnection everywhere. We can restore Britain's influence. We have so much to build on. World-leading universities, scientists at the cutting edge of future technologies, vibrant cultural industries that shape the global conversation, and home to some of the most dynamic service sectors in the world. But we cannot build on these strengths by going it alone. With Labour, Britain will be internationalist, confident and facing the future. A Britain reconnected for security and prosperity at home. Thank you very much indeed.
David, thank you very much indeed. As you promised, a great panorama of foreign policy. May I just ask you a few things? There's all kinds of very good questions flooding in. I know there's going to be lots in the hall. Right, they're coming already. You put a lot of emphasis on reconnecting Britain, on talking about alliances, on not going it alone, in your phrase. And if I were in one of those allies, I might think, that sounds great, but what about the money? Is Labour planning to put more money into specifically foreign policy, or diplomacy, aid, and the armed services?
Well, look, let's take two areas of important foreign policy. Clearly, we have been very clear we want to be a fiscally responsible government. We are in very turbulent times. Last year, I can't remember how many budgets we saw, and I think we've seen four chancellors. It's probably 2 years to a general election. Rachel Reeves has set out very clearly that she will lay out our plans for spending much closer to that election. She's right to do that. But let me signal these two things. The first thing is, at a time when countries across Europe are increasing their defence spending, it is very worrying that our defence spending has been falling and that our forces are down to Napoleonic times. I think we left office back in 2010 with defence spending at 2.5% of GDP, and it had been hovering about 2% for most of our time in office. And that is a clear commitment from Labour and how seriously we take defence in office, and that's notwithstanding the challenges that I've outlined today. And on development aid, we've also said that it is our aim to get back to 0.7%. Gordon Brown led the charge to write off world debt, Jubilee 2000, and moving in the direction of creating DFID in the first place. I set out again today, our commitment to development aid. And, of course, we want to be in a place where we get back to 0.7 as quickly as possible.
Thanks very much for that. Do you have a sense that Europe wants the UK to try and improve trade, but without all the obligations of rejoining the European Union? Is Europe going to play ball with what you've described?
I did an event with Keir Starmer, and we were discussing Europe with European colleagues across the continent, and they described the breakfast as like listening to rain on a desert. We have to get back to normalised relationships with the European Union. It is extraordinary that we do not have a structured dialogue with the European Union. We have an opportunity in 2025 to review the trade agreement that we struck with the European Union. We have an opportunity to deal with some of the issues that have come up as a result of friction I've laid out. I mean, the European Union put a security pact on the table with Theresa May and Boris Johnson. They should have grabbed that opportunity. Instead, they left it behind. We can see now with the war in Ukraine how foolish that was. So I think there's much that we can do. I hope that it won't fall to us to renegotiate the Northern Ireland Protocol and deal with the issues that have arisen in Northern Ireland. I hope that Rishi Sunak will be successful in the coming weeks on that issue. But I worry that he's weak in the face of the ERG, and he won't quite get there. So much will fall to us in office. Normalise the relationship. Build on the TCA. Those are the fundamentals of our first term.
Thank you for that. Let me just ask you one on China. It's obviously a long time since George Osborne's golden decade, but also since Gordon Brown signed agreements for bilateral cooperation, talking in similar language. And British and other countries' feelings about China are much more complicated now. What would you do about one specific element of Chinese students in universities here?
Well, look, Chinese students in universities make up a third of foreign students. Our universities are amongst the very best in the world. It's a powerhouse for our economy. There are areas, important areas, where we must cooperate with China. We have a $93 billion trade arrangement with the Chinese, hugely important. And higher education is an important part of that economy. So on trade, on climate, on health, of course we want to continue to cooperate. But we have to be clear-eyed about some of the challenges that are posed. And there are new frontiers like quantum, like biotech, like artificial intelligence, which as the global community come together to draw up the rules, I think it must be in our interests for this to be in the democratic tradition, not in the authoritarian tradition. And we've got to cooperate with our European partners and our transatlantic partners as those, as those rules are defined. And so there are going to be areas where we challenge China on human rights, and where there is fierce competition. That's signalled, of course, by the Democrats in office in the United States, but actually there's bipartisan position on that with the Republicans too. It's signalled by the EU also coming to its strategy on the Indo-Pacific region. The question is for Britain, where are we in this story? We have to be engaged. We have to be with our partners. And very sadly, it looks like you're going to have to wait 2 years for a Labour government to get to grips with this and make sure we're alongside our allies. You cannot deal with China, and we see this with their policies towards Australia and Lithuania, on your own. We simply cannot do it.
I might come back to that point. Let me come to some questions in the room. I'm going to take three at a time, and I'm going to take the online ones as well. Let's start over here. Let me take on the aisle with your hand up. Take you two. Yes, you.
James Landell, BBC. David, can you just be a little bit more, bit more explicit about development aid? I mean, you said very explicitly in that speech that you want the UK to be a development superpower. You talk about reconnecting, about showing leadership. Well, a very, very easy way of doing that is promising to spend 0.7 of GNI on foreign aid. In the grand scheme of the scale of the other budgetary pressures, particularly on defence at the moment, it's not actually that much. So why are you not doing that? Is it just political caution at the moment that you don't want to scare the horses? Or is there a broader sort of strategic reason for that? Because there are others who will say, I mean, it's an easy hit.
Thank you. In front of you? Yeah, I'm going to take three.
Lindsay Hilson, Channel 4 News. Connected. Question. This government stopped having a proper development department, and so it combined the Foreign Office and the Development Office. Would you retain that, or would you split them up again? Because it is not universally popular amongst diplomats or aid people. And a predecessor of yours, Robin Cook, referred to an ethical foreign policy. Is that a phrase you would use, or is the world just much too complicated for that?
Thank you. And one in front of you.
Thanks. David Lammy, Latika Burke from the Sydney Morning Herald. Really interested to see you refer to Australia and Lithuania's experiences with China. What would British Labor government's message to the business community be about how you would expect and hope it to see it conduct its relationships with China going forward, and what sort of strategic investments it would make and welcome? And has the Australian experience informed your thinking on that at all?
Thank you very much. Okay, so we have aid, we have the FCDO stays or doesn't, we have the ethical foreign policy exists or doesn't, and business and China. Thank you.
James, look, thank you very much for that question. We are determined to win power in 2024, and in a cost of living crisis where people are struggling to put food on the table, with inflation rising and costs soaring, it would be irresponsible for us to set out our spending at this stage. It's just too turbulent. What you have is a commitment in office to development spending, and you have our record. And our record is second to none. The truth is, if you look back since that Attlee government back in 1948. It is always Labour in office that spends and takes forward development policy, and it is always the Conservatives that destroy it and take it in another direction. So, look, I'm absolutely clear that we should not be in the situation that we're currently in, where we've got an 11.5 billion spend, which is the 0.5, with more than half of it being spent in the UK, and another half of that effectively housing refugees in hotels. That is where we've got to on our defence spending, and we will have to unpick that.
Aid spending.
What we've said in terms of the ridiculous and stupid backward decision to get rid of the Department for International Development is it was a bad idea. It should not have happened. It's hugely reduced morale. Now, we're in a state of flux here because it's clear that the government have recognised that. And that's why they moved Andrew Mitchell back in to the SCDO. And he's been pretty explicit with the problem that he's found, that he's trying to fix. I don't know quite where that's going to end up. We're 2 years probably away from the next general election. So we are committed to a new model, and we are committed to the independence, I think, and the sustained approach that you would always expect development to have. But what I've said is let us reflect on what that model should look like in the 21st century, accepting that DFID has gone, and we have an opportunity to look again at what the arrangement should be. And as we do that, we look around the world to see different models. USID, the Scandinavian and German models. Most people tell me that they're strong models. So let us look and see where we end up. Ultimately, this will be a decision for Keir Starmer, which he, I'm sure, will signal closer to a general election.
Good. Ethical foreign policy and business in China.
Look, of course, I mean, Labour has been very loud on the central issues of human rights. We've raised big issues on Iran. We've put down urgent questions on Afghanistan. Xinjiang, Parliament voted on what we perceive to be genocide, frankly, of the Uyghurs. So we've been very clear on human rights. But the policy envelope that I set out is the policy envelope we find ourselves in today. And that is not just conditioned by human rights. It's conditioned by a whole range of issues that I've illustrated. And fundamentally, I think this is a moment which calls for pragmatism in relation to UK foreign policy, not ideology. I've got the last question. Sorry, after a moment.
Business in China. What would you advise business in terms of dealing with China? This was from the Sydney Morning Herald.
What business is talking to me about at the moment are the huge challenges that are posed by huge concerns to onshore, to nearshore, to Frenchshore, hoping, of course, that we're not going to see conflict in relation to Taiwan, but having to plan and anticipate for all possibilities. What came out of the Congress at the end of last year was worrying in terms of presidency and where he now sits in terms of his strength and power and the lack, if you like, of effective counsel around him. And that's worrying for all of us. So I think what we have to plan is for all possibilities, keeping lines of communication open and hoping to cooperate where we can. But the direction of travel is worrying. And in this new multipolar environment, we have to prepare. And there are certainly critical industries in which we have to compete, frankly, in this coming era.
OK, thanks very much indeed for that. And we've covered quite a few of the questions online. Thank you, Edward Clay, for asking about the FCDO and Joseph Black for asking about China. Thanks for that. Let me come to another batch right here in the centre.
Mr. Lamy, the question I want to ask you is in relation to United Nations and the Security Council.
Thank you. And forgive me, will you like to say who you
oh,
are?
Oh, sorry. Jamil Gursel, Chatham House member, and also, Mr. Lamy, I'm a lawyer like yourself. The question I want to ask in relation to United Nations in the light of what's happening in Russia as well as in the Middle East, i.e. Israel and Palestine. Would you agree with me that United Nations now itself needs a modernization, probably abolition of the veto system in general? The five countries, they can play with the world as they wish. Do you think now this has to be reformed or just put in really the, any decision to be taken by majority rather than vetoed? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And there are two right at the back in the corner. Yeah, both of those. Thanks.
Chris Doyle from the Council for Arab British Understanding. David, the last time Labour was in power, there were 43 million people who'd been displaced by war. Today, that figure stands at around 90 million. How would your foreign policy try to address this?
Thank you. And straight behind you.
Hello, I'm Nanteet Shabawanawarak from King's College London, and I'm just wondering, ASEAN by 2022 has become the world's fifth largest economy. I'm just wondering how Labour is aiming to continue engaging with ASEAN as a growing economy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Security Council, whole range of our British questions in ASEAN.
Thank you for the question on the UN. We support the Liechtenstein initiative that would outlaw the use of the veto on issues of atrocity. We also support reform of the Security Council that would see important countries like India and Brazil with a permanent place on the Security Council. It's why I said in my speech that reform of the multilateral system must be something that the UK is present and arguing on. Now, look, I recognise that all multilateralism and the UN is the most important global forum. It's the only forum we have. It's imperfect, and there are real challenges at the moment. I think it's important to note that the United Kingdom has not used its veto since 1989. It should be used. I mean, it should not be used at all. That's where we've got to get to. That's what we'll be arguing for. The question around our position in the Indo-Pacific, I signal that I don't think this is about tilts. 50% of the global economy is the Indo-Pacific and the ASEAN region. It's central to our foreign policy. It's going to be central over the course of the next century. It's fundamental. Of course, we also want to enter the CPTPP. I don't know if it will fall to us to deliver that, but those negotiations continue. That will be very, very important for UK in the region. You'll have to remind me of the last question. I've been up since 4 o'clock this morning.
ASEAN and how we deal with the whole region.
No, I did that. There's one other question.
Displacement.
And that really relates to conflict prevention. It also actually, by the way, relates to the climate challenge and why climate has got to be such an important part of foreign policy. It's very, very sad that that has just fallen off the agenda. And of course, the truth is, if we are spending so much of our development aid effectively in the UK and it's never leaving our shores and it's just about going to hotel owners, you can see that we're sort of badly failing in relation to that. It's why international colleagues were so concerned when the government was signalling that it might be ratcheting down its spend on the Global Fund, for example. So migration continues to be almost weaponized, really, by countries like Russia, almost seeking to drive migration issues. Conflict prevention is very critical and important in any foreign affairs or development strategy. And our commitment, particularly in the region that you describe, I can't say any more than I've said in my speech, frankly.
Thank you. There are a lot of questions on that. You've answered several already. One from Joseph Black on the ASEAN, and thank you for asking that. A lot of questions online about migration and Labour's migration policy and what kind of migration you might welcome with a view to the prosperity that you say that you're pursuing. I wonder if you could take that one. There's really several on that.
Well, look, I've said that it's weaponised. I've said that it's linked. You probably need to get my colleague Yvette Cooper here to lay out migration and a policy most definitely. But clearly, some of the issues that have arisen since us exiting the European Union, the Dublin Agreement, the boats, no safe havens, has led actually to huge problems on our border with refugees. And these are problems that Yvette Cooper and her team hope to deal with as soon as we come back into the Home Office.
Let's have another batch. Okay, here on the aisle, and then in the middle, and then right at the back, and I'll come over here again.
Dominic Dudley, a freelance journalist. First of all, can I just say that your policy towards the Single Market and Customs Union is just so, so stupid and short-termist. But anyway, I wanted to ask you about the Middle East.
In what way?
Well,
not after abusive language, but I'd like you to be precise.
Okay, well, if you want to improve this country's economy, and God knows it needs all the help it can get, the best way to do that would be to rejoin the Single Market and Customs Union. Okay. Everything else is just window dressing.
Right, so your question is...
No, that wasn't actually going to be my question. No. Sorry, I was going to ask about the Middle East, if I could.
Okay.
Just a side point. You talk about wanting to do take a pragmatic stance on foreign policy and also clamp down on dirty money and kleptocrats and things like that. That's going to be quite difficult in some parts of the world, not least the Gulf. So how would you balance issues around concerns around human rights and dirty money and things like that with Britain's security and economic interests in the Gulf?
Okay. Would I pick... in the middle.
Hello, Jessica Toll, co-chair of Labour Foreign Policy Group. I also happen to be a councillor in the West End that covers Mayfair and has about 20% of the properties on your kleptocracy list are in my ward. So, David, I've...
sorry.
I, for many, many years, have listened to lots of weak words and seen lots of weak arrangements and deals and laws on things like beneficial ownership and tax avoidance. So I wondered if you could elaborate a bit on Labour's approach to this and what enforceable initiatives you might put in place that have some teeth to really tackle this problem, particularly with the property sector in the UK. Thanks.
Okay, and let me take one more. As I said, right at the back. Yep. And then I'll come to a batch over here.
Anna Joy Rickard from Tony Blair Institute and also on the Labour Group for Foreign Policy. As the geopolitical shifts happen, there's some interesting things happening in different parts of the world. I'm thinking of Francophone Africa, West Africa, very keen to forge links with the Anglophone world, for example. When you look across the world, where are the areas where we have less traditional alliances that you see possibilities and opportunities with our relationships with? Thank you.
Okay, with that one, we had Dominic's one on human rights versus national interest, and Jessica's one on weak words on kleptocracy.
Well, look, the situation following the Russian invasion was that we had a very rich debate, I think, in the UK on dirty money and kleptocracy. That debate seemed to close slightly, and the government have not implemented the full arse that was coming from the Labour Party and others. They've not really acted sufficiently on Companies House. It's still possible to register for very little money a dummy company and launder money effectively. There are issues around third parties. It's in the news again, actually, today, the role of solicitors, the role of accountants, the role of consultants in washing some of this dirty money. There are issues that arise, and it links to the previous questions. I don't want to pick a particular region, but we have raised in opposition issues around overseas territories and the opaque nature of some of the arrangements that still exist. And these are in territories where the Britain has a relationship and has a responsibility. So there's much that we can do in office. And then it's not just about setting up a sanctions regime, it's about the enforcement of that sanctions regime. It feels like the EU is doing better than we are doing, and the capabilities that exist within Whitehall clearly have to improve in the new horizon where we're at, and particularly if we're saying that state actors like the IRGC need to be prescribed, how are we going to manage that going forward? So there's a set of questions there about kleptocracy that are absolutely right. There's much more to do, and we would get on with that work in office. Look, I hear, just to go to the tone of the remarks on the single market and the customs union, easy to make those statements, but the truth is, what do they say in Brussels? They say they want consensus here in the UK. We cannot do the hokey-cokey with the European Union. It simply doesn't work like that. The first stage is to normalise relationships. You can't broker a deal if you've still got the Northern Ireland Protocol to fix. We then have the review arrangement. We do need a structured dialogue with the European Union. We haven't got them. I've set that out. So it's easy to make these assertions, but we are some way, and we shouldn't revisit the arguments that divided our nation. The worst thing that Boris Johnson did, now my record on these issues is second to none. The worst thing he did when he made his deal was he made a decision effectively not to bring the country together, but to continue to prosecute the arguments that had won him the election in the first place. We are determined in office to govern for everybody, not just to govern for those who take a particular view. The second thing I would say is that business and industry, the experience of small business, is hugely important. And the other thing that happened in our country is that they felt muted. They were not present in the debate. I think since the pandemic has receded, their voice has been louder. And of course, we've got another 2 years. We will follow what they are saying to us as we head to that review in 2025. So let's get beyond the rhetoric. Let's get beyond the tough words. Let's not pretend that this is easy. It's not. And let's get real about normalising our relationship and building on where we are so we can move forward for prosperity in our economy.
Thank you for that. I'm going to say, well, there's a flood of questions online which are about this point. Dina Mufti, would a Labour government look into rejoining the EU? Louisa Mendes da Costa, will Labour consider rejoining the EU? Lots and lots and lots of them. Is what you're saying that you're absolutely ruling it out, no, or you're going to normalise relations and then see?
No. We are going to normalise relationships and build from there. We are not re-entering the single market or the customs union.
Thank you for that. Let's come to a cluster. David Lammy has kindly said he will go on for a few minutes, so we're going to go on for a few minutes. Let's come back over here.
Thank you. Dominic Waghorn, Sky News. Are you hedging a bit on China? Can you be a bit more explicit? Do you see China as a security threat, as Rishi Sunak seemed to in the past, or is it now a systemic competitor? Where do you come down on that in that debate?
Thank you. Behind you on the aisle.
Stephen Porter, private member. I wonder if you, Mr. Lammy, realise that you are now defending a hard Brexit position, which is considerably harder than the Theresa May's deal that she offered Parliament, which you voted against.
Thank you for that. And I'm going to weave in one from online from Aditi Khanna saying, as a UK journalist covering India, what is Labour's approach to India and the proposed but delayed free trade agreement and India's expectations of greater ease of movement of professionals and students? Is that something that Labour would support?
Well, let's work backwards because India hasn't come up previously. Hugely important country is the biggest democracy in the world. I hope we're able to strike a trade deal with the Indians. Let's see if that's delivered before us coming to office, but it's obviously a very important country indeed, and I hope to be there in the coming months to cement that important relationship. It's not really about hedging on China. I mean, I can't say much more than I've said. I think that policy on China will be determined by China and by their posture, particularly to the Taiwan and the challenges in the region, and of what we're seeing feels more aggressive. I think clearly the world is learning also from what has happened with Russia and Ukraine, and that is why we are facing fierce competition following the debacle about around Huawei, now on semiconductors, and indeed as we race to green technologies. There will be issues where there will be increased competition. So that's where we are on China. I don't think there's much more to say. In a sense, it is, you know, we see where the envelope lands in relation to what their intentions are over the coming months. But I don't think it's about unnecessary fostering conflict. And I think it's hard to describe a country that at the moment sends a third of our foreign students as a threat, but there are systemic challenges, and it's certainly a systemic competitor.
Thank you. We're coming really to the end. I'm going to take one more here in the front row and two online, which are things that we haven't touched on.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Ana Irene Delgado, former ambassador of Panama to the UK and current member of Parliament of Panama. So I would like to know what would be Labour vision for the relation with Latin America, specifically Central America and the Caribbean. Having been in from years, what I was here from 2011 till 2015, the UK was one of the major investors in Panama, and that has changed a bit. So I would like to know a bit more what would be the vision of Labour on our part of the world. Thank you.
Thank you for that. One from Anita Punwani, saying, in order for Britain to regain her place on the world stage, does she have to more openly acknowledge her historical contribution to the global social and environmental crises, ensuring we actually compensate the global south for centuries' worth of loss and damage? And if yes, how can we afford to? And one from Thomas O'Brien, saying, on the UN point, would Labour support Germany having a permanent seat on the Security Council?
Working backwards, yes, we would support Germany. I think the initiative from Mia Mottley, the Bridgetown Initiative, is a good one and needs understanding. I suspect that on the issues of adaption and mitigation, it's not just about traditional aid. I think I had a discussion with the Americans about their insurance models. There are different ways to get the fund to help countries. And actually, thinking of the Caribbean region, which is a region I know very, very well, and I just have to say that I am a dual national. I have Guyanese heritage, of which I'm very proud, and I'm very frequently in South America and the Caribbean region. And I think there are big issues there around support on climate, where I would hope the UK is present. And, you know, when you think about the Commonwealth and you think about those small island states, both in the Caribbean but also in the Pacific, we can play a really big role on issues of climate. And I'm not sure we're there in quite the way that we should be. Instead, we get into petty fights about, who should be Secretary General of the Commonwealth or whatever. So I recognise the importance of the region. And I don't want to give a sense that it's losing out, but I'm weary of the government's tilt in one direction. A couple of weeks ago, we were tilting in relation to Latin America. A few weeks before, we're tilting in relation to the Indo-Pacific. We've got to be very clear-sighted about where there are important national interests for the UK to be. We've got to be smart about the way we use our power. And that cannot be all across the globe. But clearly, there are important countries that we've had historic relationships with. And there are very important countries like Mexico that we should be deepening our relations with in the region.
OK. Well, with that, we're going to have to draw it to a close. I must say, it's been interesting. Ukraine and military questions have come up less than I expected. China quite a bit, as I think we all expected. And the question that is hanging there, despite your answers, but looking at the flood of things online, is Labour's policy on Europe. So, David Lammy, perhaps if Labour is elected and you come back as Foreign Secretary, you can come here and answer the same questions again.
I know I'll have lots of support on our negotiations with Europe. Thank you very much.
David Lammy, thank you very much indeed.